Hi guys, welcome back to part two, episode 155, I think, of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. Hope you've had a good week. I am back to wrap up the story of this horrible, horrible bitch for you. And I can say that because one of her nicknames was the Bitch of Belsen, amongst other things. And so I'm going to be pretty liberal with the use of that. And she was. So first off, I just want to thank Ivy for upping her monthly pledge on Patreon. And I want to thank Eva for upping her monthly pledge to annual. Thanks, Eva. Now, I'm going to get straight into this. And I do just want to say, not that it needs to be said. It's obvious when you're talking about Nazis and Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen, there's going to be some like confronting things in it. But it's important to paint a picture of just what an absolute beast Irma Gräser was. So there will be some pretty intense stuff in this, mostly obviously because she was in charge of so many female prisoners. Most of it involves, you know, the mental, physical and sexual abuse of female prisoners. So where we left off, Irma Gräser had worked her way up from growing up in a family of farmers in a picturesque village in northern Germany to being first off a kind of lowly guard at Ravensbrück. And then she finally got, you know, her chance to shine when she was given a promotion to Auschwitz, which was like Mecca for guards in southern Poland, arguably the most famous concentration camp, and probably it is the most extensive and a kind of rite of passage for a lot of tourists now, I guess, including myself. So in the later days, I talked about how when she got there, she was kind of given office administration roles and things like that. But it was kind of in the later days of Auschwitz, kind of the last 8 months or so of its operation before it was liberated by the Red Army, that in May 1944, Irma Gräser was finally given another promotion. The only time in her life she ever kind of stood out from the crowd was when she was participating in the degradation of other women, which, you know, maybe those girls when she was growing up sensed that she was evil and that's why they bullied her. Who knows? But she would become the bully in the worst way possible. She was put in charge, as I said, on part one of 30,000 women, mostly Hungarian and Polish Jews, which she considered, there was a word for it that she used in her trial. I can't think of what it is in German. It essentially means subhuman rubbish. And as a result, she earned a lot of nicknames from prisoners, including, you know, the blonde angel of hell. And I don't agree with all the angel stuff. They seem to use angel a lot because Joseph Mengele was the angel of death. But I like the hyena of Auschwitz and, you know, later on the bitch of Belsen. Irma was only, she was 5'5", which wasn't entirely short for a woman, still taller about by an inch these days for the average woman. And she was kind of, you know, I've described her, but actually I want to say that one of my patrons, when I put up last week's episode, she said she looks exactly like the actress Elizabeth Moss. And I was like, oh my God, it's on the tip of my tongue. If you want a picture and you haven't seen a picture of her, look up, if you know Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men and a really good show called Top of the Lake, she's kind of a crazy Scientologist, not a massive fan, but a really good actress. And that show that I don't watch, The Handmaid's Tale, she looks identical to her. there's no other way to put it. So well done, Melissa. So Irma Gräser's boots, her whip and her pistol were her accessories of choice as she got around Auschwitz, often on her bicycle, which many guards did. According to History Today, female guards, including Irma, earned around 185 Reichsmarks per month, which was the currency at the time for about 20 years. It was from the 20s to the 40s, it was the currency. And this is kind of, they've compared it to what an unskilled factory job would pay per month. So it's about 2.5 times the salary. So they were earning pretty good money. And remember that their accommodation meals, everything was paid for. And as you'll find out later, Irma was stashing money away. She had about 2 years worth of savings at the end of her life, 2 years worth of, you know, wages. And I'm just saying that I don't think that Irma Gresser acquired all of that money through work salaries. So anyway, Irma's promotion to basically like a overseer, senior overseer at Auschwitz of female prisoners, mentally and literally gave her free rein to act exactly how she wanted to. Nobody forced her to do the things that she did to female inmates. In fact, later on at her trial, of which I'll read you some transcripts, inmates would say that most female guards didn't act like that. They didn't carry a whip and things like that. Irma did this purely because she got pleasure out of it. She was a sadist. A sadist is described by the Oxford Dictionary as, quote, a person who derives pleasure, especially sexual gratification, from inflicting pain or humiliation on others. So one of Irma's favourite acts was to whip the breasts of female inmates who had sizable busts. So, of course, I had to go back and see if Irma herself had one, because I thought this is probably deeply rooted in a jealousy thing. But Irma had a pretty sizable bust herself, so she probably just knew the pain that this would inflict on female inmates and the kind of damage, but also attacking the femininity of a woman. So much of this is deeply rooted in psychology, and I bet she kind of knew that, as she understood what that would do. So an inmate who worked in the, she played in the Auschwitz Women's Inmate Orchestra, which was a real thing. They would play for the guards at events and things like that, as depicted in The Pianist. She would later write a book called Playing for Time, which I've actually read excerpts from years ago. So her name's Fania Fenelon, and she wrote in her book, quote, the women had learnt to dread the penalty of her attentions, the least of which meant a whiplash on the nipple, unquote. Professor Wendy Sarti has done extensive research on Irma Gresser, and she talked about how this was kind of this sick sadist fascination with women's breasts, and that she would also be known to force prisoners to be on the lookout while she raped inmates. And she doesn't go into detail about the circumstances of that. Many of the women that were whipped across the breasts by Irma Gresser, because she carried a whip that was actually made of cellophane and it had like a wire end to it, they would develop breast infections as a result of this. Obviously, your immune system is already depleted through starvation and overexertion, lack of sleep, just the complete breakdown of your body. So you're obviously going to be susceptible to this already. And when these would develop, Irma would send them to Gisela Pearl, who I mentioned on a previous episode was an inmate and a doctor, who was put to work as a doctor in Auschwitz and luckily survived and went on to write a book about her experiences and to speak at Irma Gresser's later trial. She probably knew, honestly, Irma Gresser better than maybe anyone in the camp other than Irma's on-again, off-again boyfriend, who was an SS guard, who I'll talk about. Without even meaning to, she probably knew her more intimately than anyone. Obviously, she didn't want to know her, but she was forced to. So when these breast infections would develop in inmates, Gresser would drag them to Gisela Pearl, and she would instruct Gisela Pearl to operate on their breasts with an unsterilized knife. She would specify that. Anesthesia was obviously not an option at Auschwitz in general. And Gisela would later recall that the women would scream in agony as their breasts were cut into with an unsterilized knife. Yeah, no shit. Warfare History Network had a quote from Dr. Pearl about what she witnessed during these operations, with Irma, of course, always there watching on, salivating literally at what she was witnessing. Quote, Irma Gresser invariably arrived to watch the operation, kicking the victim if her screams interfered with her pleasure and giving herself completely to the orgasmic spasms which shook her entire body and made saliva run down from the corner of her mouth. I happened to look up and encountered the most horrible sight I have ever seen, the memory of which will haunt me for the rest of my life. Irma Gresser was enjoying the sight of this human suffering. Her tense body swung back and forth in a revealing, rhythmical motion. Her cheeks were flushed and her wide open eyes had the rigid, staring look of complete sexual paroxysm. She did this on multiple occasions so that she could relive the sadistic moment repeatedly. She always came to watch the operations of these women whose breasts had been slashed open and had become infected with the lice and dirt which pervaded the women's camp, unquote. So she's, her mind, like, I don't even care enough to try to get into it, but she was fucked. And also a reminder, this is the woman who wanted to be a nurse once upon a time, which actually was a common dream of many of the female guards who didn't achieve it, therefore decided to go into this industry instead. I found about 5 examples of major female guards at Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen who all wanted to be nurses up until the point they worked at Auschwitz. And it kind of solidifies in my mind what I said on part 2 about people who say that but never follow through with it. Now, of course, dogs were a favourite accessory for Nazis to instill fear in their captives. And actually, a few years back, I read quite a lengthy piece about how a lot of survivors of concentration camps and who lived under Nazi occupation would develop phobias of specific dog breeds or all dog breeds, but mostly they would be large dog breeds, and this would live with them for the rest of their lives. They just could not be around dogs, and it wasn't something that had been a phobia of theirs until they had experienced this. Now, obviously, German Shepherds and Alsatians were the breed of choice for Nazi Germans. Of course, German Shepherds are still one of the most popular dog breeds, and they're amazing, loyal dogs. And this is what the Nazis, you know, other than them being German Shepherds, this is what the Nazis, they were able to train them because they're such loyal breeds. Now, but they're also, like, you know, big puppy dogs, even when they're huge. I have a friend who's always just had German Shepherds and just loves them. I've never had big breed dogs. We didn't have them. We had little ones. So I'm not really sure, but I do love German Shepherds. I don't hold it against them. Irma would often be seen riding around Birkenau, Auschwitz's ginormous, sprawling death camp, on her bicycle because it's so huge. She would have either an Alsatian on either side or one running alongside her as she pedaled on her bicycle like the Wicked Witch of the West. If a woman stopped working or fell back during forced marches from camp to camp, some of which were 16 kilometres long, Irma would set the dogs on these women, which were essentially trained to rip people to shreds. And if you know anything about a dog attack, kind of what a breed like that can do. Judith Strick-Dribben, who was an inmate and would go on to write a book called A Girl Called Judith Strick, she was put on a punishment detail for whatever nondescript reason, probably did next to nothing wrong. And a punishment detail would basically be really intense forced labour until people dropped dead. They were loading trucks, these women, were with extremely heavy materials, very intense work one day. And Irma arrived with her 2 large Alsatians on leashes, and the women tried not to make eye contact with her and tried to just work and not attract Irma's attention. But then the lorry that they were loading up with all this heavy stuff kind of tipped over on itself. And I'm going to read you an excerpt of her book now. Quote, "The prisoners were completely broken in spirit. Alf Sahara and Irma sicked the two police dogs on them. The girls tried to escape their fangs, but the trained killers easily overtook them. One grabbed a Polish woman who slipped on a rock. The other fell upon a Russian girl. At Irma's orders, the capo's underlings beat and kicked the girls, still untouched by the dogs. The capo wrote down the numbers of the delinquent team. The dogs were tearing at the girls' bodies. Irma came closer to observe what they were doing. Her eyes were bloodshot. The sight of the blood seemed to intoxicate her. She panted. She was sexually excited. Everyone could see that. We stood in a trance, as at a gladiatorial combat," unquote. So again, another person saying the physical manifestation of this sadism on Irma Gressa was so obvious. Also, if you don't know what a capo is, it is a ranking in the mafia, but it's also a capo in the concentration camps was like the term that they had just for an inmate overseer who was essentially Jewish. So as I said kind of on part one, Irma would regularly stand at selections. Many survivors would say that she would often stand next to Joseph Mengele as they kind of went through and sent people either to death or to work. And if someone in the line tried to elude Irma's gaze or try to escape, she would take to them with her fists and her boots. And I'm sorry for what I'm about to tell you, but if a female inmate arrived while pregnant and went into labour, Irma Gressa would take great pleasure in tying the woman's legs together in order to get a sick pleasure out of that as a woman gave birth, which is just so evil. Again, this woman wanted to be a nurse. Irma Gressa is estimated, according to survivor accounts, to have killed single-handedly 30 prisoners a day. Over a month, that's 900. Over a six-month period, that's 5,000 inmates. But Irma didn't just get her sexual kicks from the humiliation, degradation, and physical and mental torture of prisoners. She also had extensive sexual relationships with high-ranking members of the SS and numerous guards, allegedly with the infamous Dr. Joseph Mengele, as well as with Joseph Kramer, who was the commander of Auschwitz-Birkenau at the time, pretty much the top dog, I believe. Well, of Birkenau, the commander, when you go to Auschwitz, it was Hirsch who was, I believe his title was commander of the whole lot. I don't know. I believe Joseph Kramer took over from him in late 1942, maybe. I'm not entirely sure, but Hirsch, who was one of the commanders there, is really, you see his house and stuff and people, not as part of the tour, you don't go into it, but it overlooked the main courtyard of Auschwitz I, and it's still there. And when he was tried at the Nuremberg trials, they took Hirsch back to Auschwitz and hung him in the square that he would watch from like his bedroom window, public executions happening. And I really think that's the ultimate justice, to do it where you had done it to so many people. I really enjoy that element of, the retribution of the Nuremberg trials. But Irma, who was part of a regime that decried Jewish people as dirty and outlawed sex in the legal context between Jews and non-Jews, clearly, like many of them, did not believe her own bullshit, because she had sexual relationships, many of them forced, with Jewish female prisoners. And this is what I said on part one. This is why I don't believe that most of them actually believed in the cause. They were just sick on power. They were just hyped up on the power that they were given. It's like in Schindler's List with Ralph Fiennes' character, who hires the Jewish girl from his camp to be a maid in his house, and he kind of becomes obsessed with her and falls in love with her, and he can't control it, so he starts beating her up and things like that. And Schindler says he beats you up because he's attracted to you and his mind can't kind of comprehend it. And that's a true story that happened to that woman who's in the book Schindler's Ark. Her name was Helena. One of the women that, you know, Irma would essentially force into a sexual relationship with her because you didn't have a choice otherwise, you'd be killed straight away, was what's called a block over, which was a female prisoner who was allocated a block leader in Auschwitz, because they would use their own, you know, they would use Jews as Jewish police in the ghettos and things like that in order to kind of save themselves. They'd go along with it. So she was kind of fascinated with one of these female blockovers, and it was her personal favorite. But then Irma soon grew tired of her, and she sent her for extermination, you know, pretty much straight away. Many female prisoners who survived Auschwitz noted that Irma regularly made sexual advances towards them. Iris Langer, who was an inmate of Birkenau and survived and would later testify along with many others at Irma's trial, recalled that Irma Gresser made sexual advances towards her. Now, Jews were not allowed to touch guards at all or touch, you know, anybody in authority at the camp physically, which would become like an issue, a bone of contention with things that are about to happen in this. And so when Gresser made a move towards her, Iris Langer pointed to the Star of David sewn onto her uniform, basically to say, "I'm Jewish, like, that's prohibited." And Irma Gresser told her that she was a Jew that was different from other Jews. And actually, Irma Gresser would leave her untouched and unharmed, and she would survive Auschwitz. And it just shows how they apply one rule to people that they can get something out of. And this is what I mean by I don't think a lot of them believed in their cause. They were just sickos, you know, that were waiting for the power, because before the war, they, most of them were in lowly factory jobs, especially the women, or unemployed, and suddenly they were given power. And that's why you've always got to be just on top of people who are given power, because absolute power corrupts absolutely. One survivor witnessed Irma Gresser beating a naked woman and dragging her by her hair in her house, in her apartment kind of that they were given. And this survivor saw a Georgian from Georgia, the country, a man who was sat nearby having to witness the whole thing. And this man was being forced to watch this sadistic act because the woman that was being beaten and dragged around by her hair and essentially raped by her aggressor was the woman that he was in love with. Essentially, this was punishment because this man had denied Irma Gresser, and this is what he got. She went not for him, but she knew that the best way to hurt him was to hurt the woman that he cared about. She's a sick bitch. Gresser then, not long after that, had the man shot dead, and the woman was sent to work in the camp brothel, which was just another kind of degradation of a woman who had a man that really loved her, and no one really loved Irma Gresser. According to the Warfare History Network, Joseph Mengele kind of had an on-off thing with her, even though he was married, and one day I'll do his story, but his wife kind of wasn't living in Auschwitz or in the town. She was back in Germany, and they don't talk a whole lot about him being kind of on with a lot of different people. So I found this quite an interesting fact about him, albeit he was a liar and a fraud, and he didn't believe in his own bullshit either, because when I do an episode on him, I'll talk about it. But all Nazis were required to have a tattoo under their arm. So when they did the Heil Hitler sign, it was kind of like a sign that they were a member of the tribe, you know. And he never got that because he was really kind of vain about his appearance and didn't like tattoos. And so that was one of the reasons why he was able to get away and flee to South America and hide out, you know, in Uruguay or Paraguay or wherever it was, until like the 1970s, because he didn't get it. So it just shows, you know. Also, Joseph Goebbels, who was one of Hitler's, he was in the bunker and killed himself and his wife and his whole family along, you know, at the same time that Hitler and Eva Braun did. His wife is well documented as having regular affairs with Jewish men. So these people are all fucking liars. But Mengele, he ended his relationship with her aggressor because he found out that she was having affairs with women and women prisoners. And not only did this break the provisions of a law that was called the Race and Resettlement Law, which was essentially Jews and non-Jews couldn't have sex, but it also broke a law within that law, which was homosexuality was prohibited. So she was doubly bad in Mengele's eyes, and he kind of, you know, nipped that in the bud. Gressa soon became pregnant. We don't know who the father was, but likely an SS guard that she was on with. Abortion had obviously been done, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, a lot of women didn't survive it. Hollywood, old Hollywood in the 20s, there was a lot of women, you know, had multiple abortions and they would become very sick and get infections and things, and it wasn't a safe practice. And it was done that way because it was illegal. It was outlawed. But it was also outlawed for German women. When Hitler came in as Chancellor in 1933, he made it essentially like a punishable by death offence to have an abortion if you were a German woman, because he was all about reproducing the German race, you know, and repopulating the whole world with the German race. So Irma knew that she couldn't have this child, you know, in her own mind. She probably, you know, if anyone knew about it, they would have forced her to go through with it. But for whatever reason, because bear in mind, she's only 21 at the time, 2021, and she wasn't married to the father and, you know, she was enjoying her career path. Irma called again on poor Dr. Gisela Pearl, and she did not ask the woman who would be doing this dangerous procedure on her nicely to do it. She pointed her favourite pistol at Gisela Pearl and she demanded that she do the procedure. And this was, again, an issue because Jewish prisoners could not touch guards, so she would be doing like a really intimate procedure on her, and she was scared that if anyone found out, she would be like put to death. And so Irma said, "You'll do this for me," and she offered Gisela Pearl a new coat, which probably wasn't new, it was probably just stolen from someone's luggage that had come into Birkenau, and a chance to share breakfast with Irma. That was, gee whiz, thanks. So Gisela Pearl agreed, obviously at gunpoint. She said later on that she had nothing to lose. If she didn't do it, she'd die. Irma would kill her. And if she did do it and someone found out, she'd die. So she'd die either way. So she did it. And Gressa supplied, you know, sterilized surgical instruments, of course, for herself, and made sure that she supplied them so she knew where they were coming from. And she chose a day and demanded that Gisela Pearl be there and to do the procedure. And Gisela Pearl went on to do the procedure. And she said that Irma Gressa was nervous and fearful because she knew the risks of it back then in a kind of in an environment that was dirty and typhus was rife and disease was rife. Gressa was, the only reason she was nervous and fearful was because she was worried that something would happen to her under the knife. It was never about like anyone else. It was always, the only time she cries or she shows any kind of emotion is when it impacts Irma. And of course, Dr. Gisela Pearl never received a coat. She never received her breakfast with Irma, but she wasn't shot either. So did Irma ever feel romantic, proper love for anyone besides herself? Maybe. According to Warfare History Network, Irma Gressa fell really head over heels in love with a sergeant, which the title in German was Unterscharführer. His name was Franz Wolfgang Hatzinger, and he was the chief engineer of Auschwitz I. And when they would regularly meet up for their little, you know, rendezvous, she openly bragged about how Birkenau was basically her domain, and she was judge, jury, and executioner and got off on the power that she exerted over the women there. So in January 1945, the Red Army would ultimately liberate Auschwitz, but as they were advancing across Poland towards the camp, the guards at Auschwitz began to flee or to be redispersed away from Poland, and many of them took prisoners that were well enough to walk, which wasn't many at this point, completely malnourished and ridden with disease. A lot of them were left to just rot for when the Red Army arrived, and a lot of them were forced on death marches into camps that were back away from the Red Army advancing camps in Germany mainly. Now, Irma's supposed great love, Hatzinger, who I actually did look up, and he looks young as, like, he looks in his early 20s probably, and he was already a sergeant, and he's blonde, and that's pretty much it. He was transferred to Bergen-Belsen, which is another notorious prison camp, which is located near Hanover in Germany. And Irma was devastated because she was transferred back to Ravensbrück, where her whole career began. And she was sent back there on January 18th, 1945. So extremely cold in this part of the world in winter. Gressel was not happy about this, but she only had to do a couple of months back at Ravensbrück, where they don't actually know what she did there in that time. And in March 1945, she was thrilled to be sent to Bergen-Belsen, where she would reunite with her love, Hatzinger, and get back to what she did best, which was terrorizing people who were at the end of their rope emotionally and physically already. Bergen-Belsen is perhaps best known as the final camp that Anne Frank and her sister Margot died in. They believe they died around late February, early March 1945, which coincides with the arrival of Irma Gressel. And they believe that Irma Gressel was probably a guard at the camp around the time that Anne Frank died. Anne and Margot only died a few days apart, and it's extremely sad because they only missed the liberation by a very short amount of time. And that's one of the tragedies of that whole story, that the whole family was gone. And when Otto Frank would make his way back to the Netherlands and to his amazing friends, you know, in the Netherlands that were waiting for him and that hid him and went on to live long lives afterwards, and one of them only died recently, he would, you know, find out that both of his daughters had succumbed to typhus, which was rampant throughout the camp, and nobody was coming back. His wife, his daughters, everyone was gone. So Bergen-Belsen is a notorious camp in northern Germany. It became a concentration camp officially in 1943 after kind of being a prisoner of war camp, where they would hold, you know, prisoners of war to exchange them for German prisoners of war held by, you know, the Allies, but that kind of didn't really come to pass. And ultimately they would transform it into a concentration camp, because there was just so many people that they wanted to rid Europe of. Around 70,000 died there. It's considerably smaller than Auschwitz. And there's only like a small memorial there, but you can still visit the site. Just a few months before Irma arrived at Bergen-Belsen, the ex-Auschwitz commander, Joseph Kramer, had also, you know, in the last days of Auschwitz before the Red Army liberated it, he had been sent to Bergen-Belsen, and he'd become commander of Bergen-Belsen in the December of 1944. Many Auschwitz and other Polish camp inmates were either sent on trucks, or they were forced on death marches all the way from, you know, southern Poland and Hungary and the like, to northern Germany and Bergen-Belsen, which on foot, many of them would, you know, drop dead in the process. They were essentially retreating from the Red Army on the Eastern Front, but knowing that they were heading towards the Western Front, where the Allies also were advancing. So they were being hemmed in, you know, which is good. The camp conditions at Bergen-Belsen by this stage were some of the worst in Europe. Typhus was rife, as the camp was. Even if people arrived relatively healthy, they could succumb incredibly quickly. And the camp kept getting extended and extended and extended to accommodate more and more souls who were being forced there, when they were being kind of hemmed in on all sides by different allies and different nations. They were forcing prisoners from other camps all across into Bergen-Belsen, which was kind of their last concentration camp stronghold. And prisoners were being forced to undertake hard labor here. And it's, you don't hear a whole lot about cannibalism in the camps, but at Bergen-Belsen, reports of cannibalism, even of already long dead bodies, which were rife with disease, are actually quite common and were witnessed by British and Canadian troops who liberated Bergen-Belsen. In the month that Irma arrived at Bergen-Belsen, March 1945, just that month alone, 18,168 prisoners died in Bergen-Belsen. And this was Irma's final port of call, and where she upped the ante even more. Now, a survivor of Auschwitz who you may know because she wrote a book called Return to Auschwitz, but there's also a documentary you can watch on YouTube called Return to Auschwitz, I believe. I've seen it. Her name's Kitty Hart. You'd probably recognise her. I believe she was experimented on by Joseph Mengele. She's one of kind of, I'm not sure if she's still alive. I mean, it's only a few years old, the documentary, but she's one of kind of the last remaining survivors because most of the ones that are left were somehow able to survive, even though they were children and most children were killed immediately at Auschwitz. She was essentially put on a truck convoy and sent from Birkenau as the Red Army descended upon it into Germany up to Bergen-Belsen. And she wrote in her book, quote, "The old gang, Kramer, Gresser and the rest of them must have been sent there from Auschwitz. We knew what to expect from such creatures," unquote. So here at Bergen-Belsen, Irma extended her repertoire to making prisoners kneel for days at a time. She would make them hold heavy rocks over their head during roll calls when there was no need to do that. And she would often wake them up at 3 a.m. and make them stand in the snow and ice in, you know, their striped thin pajamas that were as thin as paper by this point, stand from 3 till 9 in the morning, which is depicted in the movie The Pianist as well as a form of punishment. If someone did not stand up straight or would, you know, fall over, she would beat the prisoner with a rubber truncheon until they were unconscious or dead. They believe that she also greatly increased the death count at Birkenau by essentially being ruthless with her selections as people at Belsen. You know, by ordering selections of people just for the fun of it. On April 15th, 1945, Bergen-Belsen was liberated by the United Kingdom and Canada. Now, I have mentioned it on the podcast before, but the first time I went to London, I went to the theatre on one of the final days I was there, and I just went by myself and I saw Phantom of the Opera, which I'd seen before in Melbourne. And I sat next to this old couple. And during the interval, we were chatting and stuff for the 30-minute interval. And he told me that he was one of the first, he was British, an old British man. He told me he was one of the first people, you know, from the British Army through the gates at Bergen-Belsen to liberate it. And so I never asked his name and I just always remembered him so well. I can still picture him, just this kind of older British man. And I just thought, you know, when I was looking at all the pictures of the liberation of Bergen-Belsen during putting this together and reading all the different names and the accounts from different British prisoners, I wonder if he was one of them. I wonder if he's in one of these photos, and I don't know who he was. But, if you know anyone who participated in the war on the side of the Allies, you know, I thank them for me, for their service, because my grandfathers did, and a lot of people have reached out since part one and said, you know, particularly Americans, said, you know, that family members or grandfathers or fathers of theirs were Americans who liberated Dachau and saw horrific things and never talked about it, and, you know, it just really hits home. But right up until the eve before liberation, when the British and the Canadians were essentially on the doorstep of Bergen-Belsen, Irma Gresser was still at it. She essentially, at this point, you know, was so hard up for kicks, I guess, that she had put together this sting where she'd left out potato peels in a kitchen, in the camp kitchen. And she just sat there and waited to see if anyone came in and stole them and ate them. And if they did, she was going to lay into them. And so two sisters who were tasked with working in the camp kitchen, she caught them trying to eat their scraps of potato peels, like gee whiz. And she essentially smashed their skulls together. That was what, you know, she was into by this point. And a survivor witnessed this kind of attack by Ermagressa. She was only at Bergen-Belsen for 3.5 weeks before it was liberated, and she already had a name for herself, including the Beast of Belsen, which also was a name that went to Joseph Kramer, who had also come over from Auschwitz as well, or the Bitch of Belsen. There was another one who was not only ugly outside but ugly inside, called Elizabeth Volk or something, and she was called the Beastess of Belsen. So this, when the British and the Canadians arrived at Bergen-Belsen, many of the guards had fled or tried to flee, and they were arrested if they could catch them. And these were mainly the male guards that they were after, because they considered them kind of, obviously it was only 1 in 10 guards were women. So they were going for the men because they considered them the most dangerous. They were arresting them kind of on site, but they were letting the women go for a couple of days, essentially. But when they entered it, just like with the Americans liberating Dachau, they just found people who were walking skeletons, you know, or just laying there in a stupor, half dead. There were 60,000 prisoners inside Bergen-Belsen left behind, and there was 13,000 corpses just laying around the camp, not buried, you know, covered in flies, covered in maggots, spreading further disease. You can imagine, you can read a lot of accounts of, you know, the different allies that liberated different camps and how a lot of them, what we would call today PTSD, but at the time, back in the day, they would call shell shock. They would go home and not be able to ever speak about what they saw, especially the Americans who liberated Dachau. They would arrive and find these cattle cars with the doors all shut up. And I watched one man kind of talk about an American soldier, how he opened it up, and because they didn't know what was in these cattle cars, and each carriage was just full to the brim of dead bodies, all decomposing in there. And I also like kind of was reading about how at the different camps, because they didn't understand that when you're that starved, you can't just start eating again because it can kill you. You have to be given a specific diet, and it's kind of almost drip fed to you no matter how hungry you are. You can't just eat a full meal again. And so the Americans in particular had like chocolate and candy bars and things on them before the Red Cross arrived. And they would be trying to give these survivors like chocolate bars. And then one of their superiors kind of came along and said to them, you can't just stop. You can't just feed them. They can't just start eating again, you know, because it'll kill them, which it actually did quite a lot of them, because your body just goes into shock. So a prisoner at Belsen, Harold Osmond de Drulenec, he's French, described how in the last days of Bergen-Belsen before the Allies arrived, a prisoner took a knife and he cut out a portion of the leg of a corpse and ate it just as it was. They were that hungry. As the British would kind of document it, as they came to grips with what they were seeing at Belsen, they would be told stories about how people would just, you know, slice open dead bodies and be just putting their hands in and pulling out kidneys and livers and hearts and eating them raw. You know, the body wants to survive, and it becomes easier to do that kind of thing. According to the International War Memorial, quote, the British Army immediately began to organise the relief effort. Their first priorities were to bury the dead, contain the spread of disease, restore the water supply, and arrange the distribution of food that was suitable for starving prisoners in various stages of malnutrition. Additional military and civilian medical personnel were brought in to support the relief effort. The British faced serious challenges in stabilising conditions in the camp and implementing a medical response to the crisis. Nearly 14,000 prisoners would die after liberation. Unquote. So I just want to read you an excerpt from a man who later went on to be a BBC journalist at the time. He served in the British forces and arrived at, you know, Belsen when it was liberated, as part of that relief effort. His name's Patrick Gordon Walker. And this description from him is available on the Bill of Rights Institute website. It's just an excerpt, and he wrote extensively in the full document. It's called Erm Aggressor and Deception. Quote, "The camps were so full because people had been brought here from east and west. Some people were brought from Nordhausen, a five-day journey, without food. Many had marched for 2 or 3 days. There was no food at all in the camp. A few piles of roots amidst the piles of dead bodies. Some of the dead bodies were of people so hungry that though the roots were guarded by SS men, they had tried to storm them and had been shot down then and there. There was no water, nothing but these roots and some boiled stinking carrots, enough for a few hundred people. Men and women had fought for these raw, uncooked roots. Dead bodies, black and blue and bloated, and skeletons had been used as pillows by sick people. The day after we took over, 7 block leaders, mostly Poles, were murdered by the inmates. Some were still beating the people. We arrested one woman who had beaten another woman with a board. She quite frankly admitted the offence. We are arresting these people. An enormous buried dump of personal jewellery and belongings was discovered in suitcases. When I went to the camp 5 days after its liberation, there were still bodies all around. I saw about 1,000, unquote. So what of Erm Aggressor at this point? Well, as I said, they were focused more in the first few days on arresting the male guards there. So the female guards were kind of put to work, much like they had been doing for years with female prisoners. And they were put to work to bury the tens of thousands of corpses that were littering the site of Bergen-Belsen in order to kind of cover up, you know, to stop disease from spreading, as the British kind of forced them to do it. So Erm actually didn't try to flee at all. She kind of dug her heels in because Hatzinger, the love of her life, who was 35, even though he looks 21, he had contracted typhus because at this point most of the guards had contracted it, and it was really deadly. There was no medication or anything like that, and the place was so overcrowded even the guards couldn't avoid it. And so Hatzinger had contracted it and Erm refused to leave him. But in a form of poetic justice, Hatzinger, the love of her life, died just about a week after liberation on April 23rd, 1945, leaving Erm heartbroken, which is good. But Erm didn't just put her head down and plead ignorance when the British arrived and started hearing about this blonde beast of Belsen who had come over from Auschwitz and had caused death and destruction wherever she went. She lashed out at British army troops. She tried to sic her Alsatian dogs on them. She pulled a gun on one when he kind of tried to enter a hut that she had been kind of hiding out in. She rammed like her pistol into his back. And when he shouted at her, she ran off, you know, and hid. He would later describe this particular soldier that the Alsatian, they were so kind of bloodthirsty, her Alsatians, and so obviously like starved as well as kind of ferocious, that he saved a bullet in his gun for her Alsatian that she always got around with because he thought it was so dangerous. So Erm was not arrested immediately, but she was put to work by the British to bury bodies. Captain Derek Sington, who was a liberating officer of Belsen, he was from the British Army, and he would later testify at what was called the Belsen trial, which was the worst of the worst, when they would be put on trial in late 1945. He kind of had seen all of these, as he put it, homely Aufseherrens, and he said they all had these ugly expressions, which is the perfect way to put it, because I've actually got a picture. I'll put it up in the Patreon and probably on the website of them all kind of marching together, and they've got like these, I can't even explain it, but later on in, like, the British would nickname Ermagresser Jutjaw, which pretty much explains it really well. They've all got their kind of sourpuss faces on. And he'd seen all these women and they were in these men's jack boots and military garb, and he said they were all ugly, you know, inside and out. And then he saw this beautiful young blonde, you know, in her early 20s, Alf Saharan. She kind of stood out from the rest, and he found out that that was Ermagresser, who was arguably the worst of the lot. 2 days after liberation, Irma was arrested because they kept receiving reports about the depths of her depravity across Poland and Germany and the various concentration camps. And Ermagresser and the other Alf Saharinen, which is the plural, were imprisoned in kind of a training academy that belonged to the Wehrmacht a few kilometres away from Belsen, and, you know, guards kind of made sure they didn't get away. At this point, journalists from across Europe, particularly the UK, who were less directly impacted by the camps and things like that, had flocked across and were easily able to kind of gain access to these people who were being held pending charges, which is just so different to today. An English journalist accompanied by a French camp survivor basically interviewed Ermagresser. They asked her why she'd done what she had and committed the crime she had, and she replied pretty cavalier, quote, and she said it in German, but this is translated, as everything she said was in German and she had to have a translator at a trial and things like that. Quote, it was our duty to exterminate antisocial elements so that Germany's future would be assured, unquote. In June of 1945, Ermagresser, Joseph Kramer, who was commander of Birkenau and then moved to commander of Bergen-Belsen, and 43 other high-ranking Bergen-Belsen guards were indicted for their actions at Belsen in particular, and it was going to be a British tribunal, which is how it worked because they liberated the site. Gresser and the other guards were transferred to a prison for kind of pre-trial incarceration, and their cells were tiny, like two people couldn't even fit in them, which is another good thing. So at this stage, legal historians kind of talk about how many Nazis claimed ignorance or tried various avenues to get off execution, particularly women, and it would often work, and it would have worked, they believe, for Ermagresser had she shown some sort of repentance, but she did not. She stood firm. She was given a fair trial. She was given a defence, a British, because it was a British trial held in Germany, a British defence counsel, who I'm sure that was the worst job of his life. And she stood firm and she said that everything they did was right. And she pretty much said that throughout her trial. She was true, like right to the end, in terms of true to herself and her own beliefs. So the British held their own war crimes trial for the Belsen trial, as it was known, in the September of 1945. And it's really commendable how quickly they pulled together the various trials and would hold them for decades as they caught Nazis, you know, across the world. They would hold them in Israel, and they had the Nuremberg trials, they had the Belsen trial. This was all within months of kind of, you just got to think about it, like they didn't have like computers and things to document all these different Nazis they were looking for and who they were putting on trial and all of the documentation and survivor accounts against them and to put it together. And I've always found that really kind of incredible that they put it together like they did. They really, it was considered, you know, the most pressing thing in the world at the time. But just how they were able to start speaking to survivors, particularly with the story of Joseph Mengele, and you would hear survivors, you know, they would hear about this angel of death and this doctor that worked there. And it would take them a while to kind of compile these lists of names that would come up again and again and again before they would start kind of searching for them. So to pull together a trial for like almost 50 people within a few months, you know, it may look like it's rushed and things like that, but it was just a lot of people working on it. So it was Ermagresser, Josef Kramer and 44 others were tried. It was a military tribunal with five British officers, with a judge advocate who served as a legal advisor, and the trial lasted 54 days. There's a really good old clip I'm going to play you now from British Pathé, which is the coverage at the time of the trial, and it's got the old school writing, talking and stuff like that, but it's also just the biting way that they talked about them, which I saw again and again in different articles from the time, this kind of, you know, British, almost like kind of underhand fuck you in everything that they said. It was just really good writing. So I want to play that for you now, but there are photos of the trial. There is footage of it. And each defendant was given a number on a placard to identify themselves throughout the trial, which the top comment on the British Pathé on YouTube is how ironic that they're all given numbers, which is true. Like, what goes around comes around. I was very upset to see that Irma was number 9, which is my lucky number. She sat stone-faced and aloof, even when the most horrific photographs of the fallout after the liberation of the camps was shown. And she was really, according to most people, more concerned about her hair being perfectly coiffed, how she looked, and making sure that, you know, she always had her comb on her to fix up her hair.
Justice on the British model is given to those who had other ideas of how prisoners should be treated. The Belsen war criminals arrive at Lüneburg for trial. Their faces give little clue to what they're thinking. Last out of the lorry is Josef Kramer, the beast of Belsen. The calm orderliness of the scene contrasts violently with the ghastly pictures which shocked the country when they were shown in British newsreels. Our cameraman, Kenneth Gordon, covers the opening scenes of the trial. Kramer's chief woman assistant, Irma Kleiser, wears the curls. Major General Bernie Ficklin presides over the court, and the prisoners have been provided with Allied officers as defense counsel. Each prisoner wears a number for identification purposes, though the cards were taken off at a later stage of the trial. Next to Kramer sits Dr. Fritz Klein, German medical officer at Belsen, a man with a loaded conscience. Chief saddest among the women, Irma Gresser, number 9, sulked her way impassively through the long tail of fodder. After 12 years of Nazi thuggery, one wonders what the Germans think of British justice. They may well mistake fairness for weakness.
So, yeah, isn't that great? The coverage of it. So Irma spent kind of, if you watch it, she's just kind of almost got a smirk on her face. That's why they say she kind of sobs kind of when it suits her, which is always just when things are brought up that directly affect her life. She continually glared at, you know, different people in the courtroom. And this is when the British soldiers nicknamed her Jut Jaw because of how she sat with her jaw like kind of sticking out. She said in her defense at one point, Himmler is responsible for all that has happened, and I suppose I have as much guilt as the others above me, unquote. Now, there was another woman who was on trial at the time, and you can watch kind of footage of her. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of footage of Irma talking or her execution, but this one called Herta Botha, she was at Bergen-Belsen for a couple of years. She was arguably just as bad as Irma Gresser was at Auschwitz. And she was tried in this and sentenced to kind of like 20 years in prison. And she was let out by 1951, like with leniency from the British government. So I guess if Irma had played her cards right and tried to show some sort of remorse, she may have got off. But luckily for us, she didn't. Irma's unfortunate British defence lawyer didn't have much chance to defend her. Really, his tact fell on trying to trip up witnesses with their statements, which didn't really work. And he tried then the poor Irma tact by bringing her sister Helena, who I've talked about before, Helena Gresser, to the courtroom to kind of defend her. I don't believe her father ever came to court or had anything to do with her, like after what we talked about in part one. Helena talks about that in the transcript I'm about to read to you. You know, he was so anti what she was doing and anti Nazism, Alfred Gresser, despite being a registered Nazi, that, you know, I don't think he would have allowed himself to, like, even go to the trial. Like, he still had some pride. So in this transcript, which is available from the Holocaust Research Project, it's got a transcript of them questioning Helena. Then they've got a bit of a transcript of Irma in court. And then they've got the trial transcript of Irma's defense lawyer basically cross-examining one of the witnesses who survived the camps. So this is Helena Gresser testifying and being questioned by Irma's defense team. So you'll be able to tell when I ask a question, it's from the defense team. Quote, I am the sister of Irma Gresser, 20 years old, and I live in Vreken in Vrekensburg. My father was an agricultural worker, and I have two sisters and two brothers. My mother died in 1936. When she was 14 years old, my sister Irma worked on a farm of a peasant in a village near where we lived. From the time she entered the concentration camp service, I saw her twice. In 1945, she came home on leave, and the only thing she told us about her work was that her duties consisted of supervising prisoners so that they would not escape. I saw her when she left Auschwitz in 1945, and she told me that she had been working for a considerable period in a sort of post office, receiving and distributing mail, and that sometimes she had been detailed to guard duties. From your knowledge of your sister, do you think her as a person likely to beat the prisoners under her charge? No. In our school days, when, as it sometimes happens, girls were quarrelling and fighting, my sister never had the courage to fight. And on the contrary, she ran away. When your sister went to work on the farm when she was 14, how long did she stay there? About 6 months to a year. Where did she go from there? She went to Hohenleken as a sort of nurse, and then to a small dairy in Fürstenberg where she worked, I believe 12 to 18 months. Did she go from there into the SS? Yes, in 1942 she went to Ravensbrück, which was very near to us. How long before 1943 was it since you had seen your sister? In spring 1942, when she was working in the dairy. When she came home in 1943, did your father give her a thrashing? I did not see that, but he was quarrelling with her because she was in the SS. Did he forbid her to come to the house again? I do not know. She never came again. Was not that because she told you what she did at Ravensbrück? I do not know why. You would be 16 at that time. You never asked what she was doing in the concentration camp, and she never told you. She told us she was supervising the prisoners working inside the compound, and she had to see that they were doing their work well and that they did not escape. We asked her, what do the prisoners get for food and why have they been sent to the concentration camp? And she answered that she was not allowed to talk to the prisoners and did not know what sort of food they got. Why did your father lose his temper with her? Because he was very much against her being in the SS. We all wanted to belong to the Bund Deutscher Mädchen, but he never allowed us to do so. I have not seen my father since April 1945, unquote. And this is Irma Gresser. Testimony of her being questioned by her lawyer, Major Cranfield. Did you carry a stick at Auschwitz? Yes, an ordinary walking stick. Did you carry a whip at Auschwitz? Yes, made out of cellophane in the weaving factory in the camp. It was a very light whip, but if I hit somebody with it, it would hurt. After 8 days, Commandant Kramer prohibited whips, but we nevertheless went on using them. I never carried a rubber truncheon. Where did the order come from for what we call selection parades? That came by telephone from a Rapportführerin or the Oberaufseherin Dreschel. When the order came, were you told what the parade was for? No. What were the prisoners supposed to do when the whistle went? fall in fives, and it was my duty to see they did so. Dr. Mengele then came and made the selection. As I was responsible for the camp, my duties were to know how many people were leaving, and I had to count them, and I kept the figures in a strength book. After the selection took place, they went into B camp, and Dreschel telephoned and told me that they had gone to another camp in Germany for working purposes or for special treatment, which I thought was the gas chamber. I then put in my strength book, either so many for transfer to Germany to another camp or so many for SB, Sonderbehandlung. It was well known for the whole camp that SB meant the gas chamber. Were you told anything about the gas chamber by your senior officers? No, the prisoners told me about it. You have been accused of choosing prisoners on these parades and sending them to the gas chamber. Have you done that? No, I knew the prisoners were gassed. Was it not quite simple to know whether or not the selection was for the gas chamber, because only Jews had to attend such selections? I myself had only Jews in Camp C. Then they would all have to attend the selection for the gas chamber, would they not? Yes. As you were told to wait for the doctors, you would know perfectly well what it was for. No. When these people were parading, they were often paraded naked and inspected like cattle to see whether they were fit to work or fit to die, were they not? Not like cattle. You were there keeping order, were you not? And if one ran away, you brought her back and gave her a beating. Yes. And this is examination by her defence counsel. The witness Zafran has accused you of beating a girl at Belsen with a riding crop about a fortnight before the British troops arrived, and also that at Auschwitz during a selection, two girls jumped out of a window and you shot them while they were lying on the ground. Is that true? I never shot at all at any prisoner. And this is earlier, where the prosecution had cross-examined that particular woman that was mentioned, the witness D. Zafran, as they're known. And I'm going to read you the cross-examination transcript of that particular survivor. Whilst you were at Auschwitz, did you see any other persons beaten besides yourself? I saw it very often when I was working in Commando 103 and we were carrying loads of earth and coal. I've seen Kramer beat a person so often that I cannot really say how many times. I have seen Gresser do it in Auschwitz, and about a fortnight before the British troops liberated Belsen, I saw her beat a girl in the camp. She had a pistol and she was using a riding crop. The beatings were very severe. If they were not the cause of death, they were not called severe in the camp. And this is Gresser's counsel cross-examining the same woman. Do you remember telling us that you had seen Gresser, number 9, beating a girl in Belsen about a fortnight before the British troops arrived? I remember it now. I was in the kitchen. Gresser was not the kitchen commandant. She came commandant. She came in there with the Lager commandant on inspection. She beat the girl with a riding crop made out of leather. If I tell you that at Auschwitz, Gresser carried a stick and sometimes a whip, but at Belsen, she never carried neither. Are you sure that you are not confused over this incident? In Auschwitz, she wore a pistol, and in Belsen, she went about with a riding whip. She was one of the few SS women who had a permit to carry arms. I cannot say whether she was wearing a pistol at the time of this incident. Perhaps it is possible that by that time members were not allowed to carry arms. And then the prosecution re-examines her. You said that you could tell us a good many more instances of Gresser's conduct. Yes, in Camp A, Block 9, Block Altesteria and Hosler and Dr. Enna, the prison doctor, made a selection for the gas chamber, and two selected girls jumped out of the window and Gresser approached them as they were lying on the ground and shot them twice. She was always active in the camp gate making inspections, and if any of the prisoners wore another sock or shoe or anything like that, he or she would be beaten up. I cannot remember what she used to beat them because I had to stand at attention. You've been asked a good many questions about dates. Were you given calendars, either at Auschwitz or Belsen? No, but I remember very well because they were so terrible and ghastly. So then it goes back to Irma Gress's examination by her own counsel. And just to kind of clarify, obviously they're just trying to trip her up, Irma Gress's team, on technicalities and things like that, on tiny little details. And obviously it was just overwhelming because there were so many witnesses on the stand for Irma Gresser saying what she had done. So this is Irma's examination by her own counsel. The witness Stein told us that at a selection in the summer of 1944, some prisoners tried to hide, but that you saw them, told somebody, and a woman was shot. It was suggested that the woman is shot by an SS man or guard. Had you any authority to issue orders to an SS guard? No. The same witness alleged there was an incident when a mother was talking to her daughter over the wire between two compounds, that you arrived on a bicycle and beat the mother so severely that she was lying on the ground where you kicked her. I do not deny that I beat her, but I did not beat her until she fell to the ground, and I did not kick her either. And this is the cross-examination by Irma Gress's defence counsel of that particular woman. With regard to the incident you described of a woman being shot when trying to escape from a selection parade in Auschwitz, was she Hungarian? Yes. You described an incident where Gresser arrived on a bicycle and beat another woman. Did she beat her with her belt? I do not know exactly what was in her hands, but I did see that she had something in them. I do remember, however, that I have seen Gresser taking off her belt and beating prisoners with it. Was the body taken away on a stretcher by hand, or was it taken away by something on wheels? When somebody died, which happened in very many cases, he was simply put into a blanket and dragged away. Have you ever been beaten by Gresser yourself? No, not in the kitchen where I was working. But once, when I was out on a working party, Gresser saw me talking to somebody through the barbed wire and she immediately started beating me. Did you see Gresser beating a great many people a great many times at both camps? I saw her more frequently doing this in Auschwitz than in Belsen. Was the reason you only had this one beating from her because you behaved yourself well? I had not very great contact with her because working in the kitchen we were rather separated. Whilst I was at Birkenau, an SS woman named, this is her deposition. Whilst I was at Birkenau, an SS woman named Irma Gresser was responsible for many beatings, one murder and sending people to the to the gas chamber. I identify number two on photograph Z42 as Irma Gresser. What I speak of, I speak to my own knowledge. In July 1944, I was working in the camp at Birkenau when I saw a woman whose daughter was in an adjoining camp go to the dividing wire in order to speak to her daughter. Gresser, who was passing on a bicycle, immediately got off, took off her leather belt and beat the woman with it. She also beat her on the head and face with her fists, and when the woman fell to the ground, she trampled on her. The woman's face became swollen and blue. A friend of the woman's daughter took her away, and the woman was in the hospital for 3 weeks suffering from the effects of the beating. I saw everything myself that Gresser did to this victim. Whilst at Birkenau, I have seen Gresser making selections with Dr. Mengele of people to be sent to the gas chamber. On these parades, Gresser herself chose the people to be killed in this way. In one selection, about August 1944, there were between 2,000 and 3,000 selected. At this selection, Gresser and Mengele were responsible for selecting those for the gas chamber. People chosen would sometimes sneak away from the line and hide themselves under their beds. Gresser would go and find them, beat them until they collapsed, and then drag them back into line again. I've seen everything I describe. It was general knowledge in the camp that persons selected in this way went to the gas chamber. Sometime in August or September 1944, at one of these selection parades, one Hungarian woman who had been selected tried to escape from the line and join her daughter in another line, which was for those not chosen. Gresser noticed this and ordered one of the SS guards to shoot the woman, which he did. I did not hear the order, but saw Gresser speak to the guard and she was shot at once. In the company of some nurses from the hospital, I took the dead body to the mortuary. And then this is Irma Gresser under prosecution questioning by Colonel Backhouse. You affected heavy top boots and you like to walk around with a revolver strapped to your waist and a whip in your hand, did you not? I did not like it. You thought it very clever to have a whip made in the factory, and even when the commandant told you to stop using it, you went on, did you not? Yes. What was this whip really made of? Cellophane paper plaited like a pigtail. It was translucent like white glass. The type of whip you would use for a horse? Yes. Then most of these prisoners who said they saw you carrying a riding whip were not far wrong, were they? No, they were not wrong. Did the other Elf Saharan have these whips made too? No. It was just your bright idea? Yes. In Lager C, you used to carry a walking stick too, and sometimes you beat people with the whip and sometimes with a stick. Yes. Were you allowed to beat people? No. So it was not a question of having orders from your superiors to do it. You did this against orders, did you? Yes. Were you the only person who beat prisoners against regulations? I do not know. Did you ever see anyone else beat prisoners? Yes. Did you sometimes get orders to do so? No. Did you give orders to the other Elf Saharin and under you to beat prisoners? Yes. Had you the right to give such authorization? No. On November 17th, 1945, Irma Gresser and two other female guards from Belsen were sentenced to death. When the death sentence was translated into German for Irma to understand, it was Tod durch den Strang, which means death by the rope, which I almost named part two that in German, but then I thought people would see it and be like, what the hell is this? Irma was completely unrepentant in the court, stone-faced, but back in her cell, just like she had cried when they talked about, her sister talked about her fighting with her dad and him casting her out and stuff, because this was another thing that impacted Irma, she was seen like sobbing in her cell. So apparently the whole stone-faced, resting bitch face thing was probably a cover. So ultimately, Irma, even though she believed in everything she had done and believed she was right, she appealed this death sentence and her appeal was rejected. By this stage, she probably was just feeling bad that she hadn't just said, I'm sorry, and like a lot, and been sentenced to life, which would have never been life. A lot of them were released within like a decade or less. 2 days after her appeal was thrown out, in mid-December 1945, a very dark winter for Irma, Irma was transported with 12 others to her final destination, Hemeln Prison. Now, Britain actually had to fly in their own executioner because it was a British military trial, and they flew in Brit, who was known as Britain's official hangman. He kind of was like a executioner, hangman, back when Britain still had, you know, hanging as the death penalty, and would for a couple of decades after this still. His name was Albert Pierpoint, and he was flown out to Hemeln Prison to basically in one day execute all of these people with like a half hour, you know, tea break in between. Albert Pierpoint decided that even though he did the men in pairs, because they created like a gallows where you could fit two people on the gallows that would hang. And this was to speed up the whole process. And while they were going to execute the men two at a time, he decided that they were going to execute the three women that were found guilty and sentenced to death individually for whatever reason. So the three women were all grouped together and they were unrepentant until the very end. Their final night in Hemeln Prison, they all sang Nazi, you know, patriotic songs that were sung by the Nazi party late into the night. And by the way, one of these women who was, you know, executed alongside Irma also wanted to be a nurse before she got a job at Bergen-Belsen, which is hilarious. So the British constructed this gallows and they set about early the following morning, you know, wrapping up these executions. Albert Pierpoint, the hangman of Britain, would ultimately write a biography, which I would actually love to read. And he describes all of the events leading up to Irma's execution and the hanging as follows. Quote, "At last, we finished noting the details of the men, and RSM O'Neill ordered, 'Bring out Irma Gresser.' She walked out of her cell and came towards us laughing. She seemed as bonny a girl as one could ever wish to meet. She answered O'Neill's questions, but when he asked her age, she paused and smiled. I found that we were both smiling with her, as if we realised the conventional embarrassment of a woman revealing her age. Eventually she said 21, which we knew to be correct. O'Neill asked her to step onto the scales." So they had to hang her, obviously. So they had to weigh her. But I just love the whole British element of that, that everyone's like, oh, trying to be all polite because they've asked her age. Also, she wasn't 21, she was 22. So she was a liar through to the end because she has the kind of, she has an accolade that I'll tell you in a minute. She achieved something in her life at least, like a Guinness World Records. So basically they had to weigh them in order to make sure that they were killed, you know, pretty quickly instead of just hanging there for, you know, hours afterwards waiting for them to die. And they found that Irma was 5'5" and 1/4 inches tall and she weighed 150 pounds. So they gave her a drop length of 7 feet, 4 inches, which makes it feel very real when you talk about the length of the rope. So on December 13th, one of her co-accused, who was that she was just horrible, they called her like the Beastess of Belsen, Elizabeth Vulcanrath. She was executed first at 9:34, and then Irma Gresser was the next one at 10:03. Pierpoint would later write in his biography, quote, "At 9:34, she walked into the execution chamber, gazed for a moment at the official standing round it, then walked to the center of, sorry, I got theirs wrong. Irma's was 9:34, Vulcanrath was an hour, half an hour before that. Quote, "At 9:34, she walked into the execution chamber, gazed for a moment at the official standing around it, then walked onto the centre of the trap where I had made a chalk mark. She stood on this mark very firmly, and as I placed the white cap over her head, she said in her languid voice, 'Schnell!' The drop crashed down and the doctor followed me into the pit and pronounced her dead. After 20 minutes, the body was taken down and placed in a coffin ready for burial," unquote. Now, apparently Schnell, which she yelled out like Austin Powers, like right-hand woman yell, send in the guards in Austin Powers. That's how I picture it. Apparently it means like hurry up or make it quick or something. So Irma Gresser was dead. Now, the British had started giving people injections into their pericardium of their heart of chloroform when they were about to be executed, which would basically mean that it would speed up their deaths because normally when they were hung, they would leave them suspended from the rope for an hour afterwards, which was normal practice in England, because sometimes it would take them like that long to be brain dead. But Irma was well and truly dead within 20 minutes, and they're not sure whether or not they had injected them with these pericardial injections of chloroform, but, I mean, whatever. Irma Gresser was 22 years old. An article from the next day in 1945 described Irma as, quote, "the blonde pistol-packing beastess of Belsen," unquote. Irma had achieved something in her life. At only 22 years of age, she was the youngest Nazi war criminal hanged and also the youngest person ever hanged by the British during the 20th century. So her body was ultimately cut down and it was put in kind of like an unmarked grave in the prison courtyard. And then in 1954, Irma Gresser's body was exhumed and it was reburied in an actual cemetery, which kind of sucks, but whatever, called Amvel Cemetery, which is not far from the prison where she died. Joseph Kramer was executed the same day at midday. After the execution, Irma's personal belongings were handed over to her sisters, Helena and Lieschen, and they found that amongst them was 439 Reichsmarks, I have trouble saying that, in cash, and her bank book showed that she had a balance of 4,391.57 Reichsmarks, which I calculated it, and it's like over 2 years' worth of wages on her wage. So she was either not spending any money because everything was covered, or she was not spending any money because she was stealing from other people, essentially. But everything just went to them, and that was the end of that. Her dad never spoke about it publicly, nothing like that. And Irma Gressler was dead at 22. There's nothing really to say about her. I mean, she should have never existed. She's kind of like a really rare kind of woman. You don't get this kind of sadism, especially sexual sadism. I guess Rose West was one of those, or Myra Hindley, both in Britain, were kind of those types. Or, you know, going back centuries, Elizabeth Bathory, but you don't get that very often. And she was kind of an aberration. She should never have existed, and she sucks. And that's the end of Irma Gress's story. I don't really know how else to wrap that up. Yeah, that's it. I hope that you've kind of learned something from Irma Gress's story, at least how not to live your life, or how power can corrupt, or, you know, maybe red flags to look out for in people, who knows. Although leading up to that, there didn't appear to be any red flags, although I don't really believe her sister's testimony. I think they're both liars, totally indoctrinated. So, you know, I take it with a grain of salt, even her sister saying that she ran away from fights. You know, knowing the kind of character of these two women, it's likely that she was the one throwing punches when she was a kid. We just don't know. But yeah, she sucks, and she gave us women, you know, a bad name. At some point I will cover other Nazis as well as those that went on the run. So stay tuned for that. I've got one planned kind of coming up in a couple of months maybe. But I just want to thank Cheryl for requesting Poland so that we could cover the horrible case of Irma Gressa. I only wish that I'd done it on the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz to give it a bit more meaning. But yes, now I'm quickly going to go through world headlines now. I have not had much of a chance to really look at the news this week, but I've got you a few zingers. Speaking of people who appeal sentences for horrific crimes they clearly did in cold blood, Oscar Pistorius will be given 24-hour police protection if freed on parole next month, after cops were told he faces threats to his life outside prison, having served half his sentence for the murder of Reeva Steenkamp. So I followed, this is from the Daily Mail, on the 15th of February, I followed this as it was happening, obviously. I remember the day that it actually, the story broke, because it was like Valentine's Day. I watched the whole trial, you know, I was really into it. I believe Oscar Pistorius, you know, I'll never cover him on this because it just doesn't fit the podcast, but he's a psycho with rage issues that were well demonstrated, controlling of women, coercive control, victim status, maximum victim status, I guess like through his disability that he was born with. And then on top of that, he killed someone in a rage and he lied about it. And I think most people are on board with that. Now, what pisses me off is that the state in South Africa will have to pay for this, taxpayers. And this is already a country where a lot of people live in poverty. Oscar Pistorius is at the other end of that, thanks to having a very rich family. Even though his parents are dead, he was, you know, his very rich uncle that bankrolled his whole ridiculous defense. And he's been, you know, threats to his life. Her parents, Reeva Steenkamp's, have been incredibly gracious, I believe, through this whole thing. I wouldn't have handled it half as well as that, but just the whole back and forth with the initial ridiculous sentence of 5 years or whatever it was, and then the prosecution appealing and it went up, and I got really lost with it back and forth. It landed on 13 years, which I thought was probably fair, even though I think fair would be life. And he's been sent, he's been had a pretty cushy existence in prison because he's in like a hospital ward because of his legs. He can't be in the general population. So he's had it pretty sweet. He shouldn't complain. But I think doing 7 years after wasting so much time in court and just the ridiculous story that was proven impossible by forensics and stuff, just the text that he sent to her, I implore you to read them. Listen to what his ex-girlfriend said. The guy has the biggest ego ever, and I'm glad that he's lost everything because it was always going to lead to that. And you know what sucks? Like, I was living in England when the British, the London Olympics were on in 2012, and my flatmate at the time loves the Olympics, like, and he loved the Paralympics as well. And it was right, you know, the year before this all happened. And Oscar Pistorius was on every Blade Runner. He was on every newspaper. He was the toast of the town. You know, this guy's amazing. He's so talented. He's so good looking. He's overcome all of this. And I think that he honestly thought he was so loved and so kind of pitied that he could honestly get away with this. And yeah, I just, like, I don't, like, it's just, what I just said on the Irma episodes, it doesn't matter to me that he's got a disability because he, look how much he achieved as a result of that. It doesn't change his character. It doesn't affect his brain. You know, it's chilling reading the text that he sent, the control. Don't you dare talk to people without me. You know, don't you ever leave a party without me. Don't you ever walk in front of me, all this crazy shit. And I'm glad, you know, that he feels like he needs police protection. But I feel like 529 comments on that article also felt that he should pay for it. And I know he's broke, but, you know, shit happens. The next story is very sad. Boy rescued from Thai cave dies in the UK. Teenager who won scholarship at Leicester Football Academy and told his father, "Don't worry, Dad, I'll study hard," dies after sustaining head injury 5 years after he and teammates survived 18 days in flooded cave. So if you remember that, the Thai football team was stuck in that cave and, you know, those amazing divers got them out and it was like a worldwide story. And this kid went on to get this scholarship to this boarding school and a sports scholarship for soccer in Leicester, and he was going to be big and he was such a, just reading about him, he was such a like good boy, you know. Sounds so dumb to say that, but he was only like 18 years old, barely, like 17, 18. Anyway, the details are kind of scarce on this, but he something happened and they said that no one else was involved in it. I believe he fell. That's kind of what I've pieced together, at his boarding school, and he sustained some sort of head injury. They haven't really said, or he was playing something and he got hit in the head and he died. And I just so sad. The opposite of Oscar Pistorius, to overcome all of that. And he was such a like nice, good boy, you know, because I love the Thais. And for that to be like the end of the story is just so sad, so tragic. And from what I've read, it was totally like avoidable, whatever happened to him at the boarding school. And yeah, just horrible. I just feel so sorry for his parents back in Thailand. The final story was, I only just like an hour before I recorded this came across it. And that was because I was listening to this week's last podcast on the left. They've just today dropped a new series that they're starting on David Miscavige, who's like the head of Scientology, and Tom Cruise's mate. And the head since L. Ron Hubbard died in like the 80s. And they always do such good research and stuff. So at the end of part one that they just dropped today, they said, oh, this was really good timing to do this because David Miscavige has just, he's just been like indicted on a human trafficking lawsuit involving like three Australians. And I was like, what? They were like, this only happened like 2 days ago. So I immediately went and looked it up because I was like, oh my God, I missed that. And I listened to a couple of Scientology podcasts. So one of them's called The Underground Bunker, which one of the guys who left Scientology does. And I only follow it because he did really good research on the Danny Masterson rape trial. Like, he was at the court every day, and because cameras weren't allowed, he was like, during breaks, he would go on like live feeds and say what had happened. And so he was like an amazing source during that, which has kind of been like a hung jury, unfortunately. And then the other one is, I can't think of what it's called. Going Clear was the documentary. I listened to the one with Leah Remini and Mike Rinder. Fair Game, it's called. It's been around for a few years. It's really, really good. They talk to different people from Scientology, and it's just really interesting. Anyway, David Miscavige, like, what has happened, and I'm going to read to you an article from the Sydney Morning Herald, because it somehow involves Australia, and I just want to read it to you because this is like a big deal in terms of Scientology and nailing them for something, especially like the top dog, because the LAPD, like, they give tons of money to the LAPD, which is why a lot of people think that the LAPD has done nothing to follow up investigations, look for David's missing wife. There's been a lot of, like, obfuscation. Listen to Leah Remini talk about it and Mike Rinder on the podcast, Fair Game. But I'm going to read this to you quickly because it's a bit complicated. Scientology's reclusive leader, David Miscavige, has 21 days to respond to allegations from a human trafficking case brought by three Australian residents after nearly a year of avoiding legal service. Gavain Baxter, Laura Baxter, and Valeska Paris have claimed in a civil case lodged in Florida that they had endured horrendous emotional, physical, and psychological abuse while in Scientology. Now, a US magistrate has ruled that Miscavige has been concealing his whereabouts for nearly a year and declared him officially served in the case. Miscavige, leader of Scientology since 1986, has been named in the lawsuit filed last April, along with five Scientology-related organizations. He had been the only defendant to not have been served. The court heard allegations from plaintiff lawyers that Miscavige had evaded service 27 times, including by ordering security at Scientology properties to prevent the summons from being delivered. Miscavige's lawyers had also refused to accept service for him last month. The lawsuit, backed by US class action law firms, is regarded as one of the most significant in decades regarding Scientology, considered by some critics as a dangerous, money-focused cult. And it goes on and on. And this will be really interesting kind of to follow. Clearly, like, if you just dodge the people trying to serve you forever, you know, he's been doing that for a year, which is, like, why I think his wife is dead, and I've always thought that a lot of people think she's kind of chained up and still alive and stuff. I reckon that whoever the LAPD claims to have seen when they did a welfare check that Leah Remini, you know, requested, I believe it was just any woman. I don't believe they checked it was even Shelley Miscavige. The whole thing is so sketchy, and I hope the whole cult comes to an end. It's so dangerous. It has caused so much heartache for people. But honestly, I'm never hopeful when it comes to it, because they've got so much power. This is what the Fair Game whole thing is, and this is what the Going Clear thing is in auditing. You have so much on so many people. I really suggest going and listening to last podcast on the left series on L. Ron Hubbard, which was like five parts about 4 years ago that they did. And now they've started the David Miscavige series and kind of leading on from that. And it just, they do such good research, and it just paints it. Stephanie Harlow also did a recent one on Scientology, but there's just so much to it. But it just paints such a psychotic picture of this. Like, they're so celebrity focused in order to get members. And I always think it was too much for Charles Manson, which means it was crazy, because he went to a Scientology thing in the 60s when they were trying to recruit kind of celebs of the time when it was new and upcoming. And even he said it was full of crackpots. And if he says that, we've got an issue. So I'll kind of stay on top of that and see what happens. But go and check out those, because I just think if the heat gets turned up on these people, they've gotten away with stuff for far too long. And I just don't even want to know what goes on in the Scientology centres, the one in LA, the massive one in Clearwater, Florida. Like, I've thought a lot about this, you know, what they've got on different people, just making people purge their sins and then using that against them for the rest of their lives, which is what they think has happened with, you know, John Travolta and, you know, different people not, you know, accessing medical treatment, you know, Kirstie Alley died recently. She was a big Scientologist. Lisa Marie Presley was for a while, and then she left it. Kelly Preston, married to John Travolta, she died of cancer, like didn't have treatment. Like, you know, how dangerous these people are, you know, to the health and mental health, physical and mental health of the people in their organization. They suck. It's not real. Science fiction. So that is world headlines for this week. I will be back probably in about 10 days because we just had a heat wave. We have a bit of a lull at the moment for a couple of days, and then there'll be another one. And without air conditioning, like as I exist in my current residence and have for a few years now, it's not pretty. And it's just kind of like knocks it out of me a bit, that's all, because I'm quite like very sensitive to the heat. And so the summer's almost over, which is good. It's actually been quite a cool kind of last month or so. It's been very strange, like, you know, have heaps of blankets to sleep and stuff, but now it's really amped up, and later this week again it will be for days and days and days. So I'll be back once all that passes. Join the Patreon, leave a rating or review. The PayPal is unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com. No case requests at the moment because I've got enough on my plate. And I probably, what else was I going to say? If you contact me or anything, I can't reply to every email, like, unfortunately, I always reply saying thanks and, you know, thanks for listening and stuff. But I like really big detailed ones. I just can't do it anymore. Like, this isn't my full-time job. And I've said that like quite a lot, on top of having other kind of challenges in my life with my health and wanting to have a personal life and stuff. It may take me a while to get back to you if I do. I will be back when I'm back. Have a really good week, and I'll talk to you soon.